Start with our first case, 20-2180, United States versus Topete Madrueño. Mr. Ray, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. I appreciate it, and may it please the Honorable Court, and of course, my esteemed opposing counsel, Mr. Fitzenmeier. I'm here to talk about two big overarching issues, Your Honors. The first one is what is reasonable from the standpoint of law enforcement searches and seizures when they have obtained a search warrant related to a residence and they have learned that the person has relocated to another residence. What is reasonable as far as going ahead and going forward with the search warrant that they obtained on the previous residence? The second issue, the big issue I want to take up, has to do with when your roommate is the target of a narcotics investigation and no evidence is developed against you, is your vehicle the rightful subject of a search of premises, even if question one, the answer to that is the original search warrant still had probable cause. So I'm going to take those up in that order, Your Honors. What you had with reference to the first question is you had an ongoing narcotics investigation based on what's in the search warrant and the testimony adduced at the suppression hearing and at trial. What we learned was that an organization that the government calls the Samaniego via drug trafficking organization was being investigated from around February of 2018 through August.
Mr. Ray, can I sort of cut to the heart of the matter on your first issue, please?
Yes, sir.
And that relates to the question of when they knew that that the target, if you'll use that phrase, of the investigation, and since my Spanish is not very good, that's an easier way to phrase it. When the target of the investigation had left that home and had relocated to another home. I mean, you had the testimony of the agent at the suppression hearing saying they did not know that he had left the home and relocated until they were actually executing the search. And the district court found that testimony to be credible. And given that, what basis is there to view that as clearly a clearly erroneous finding? And if it is not a clearly erroneous finding, then that's the governing factual scenario. That's the universe that they did not know at the time that they executed the search warrant that he wasn't there.
Judge, when you look at the search warrant that Agent Palat obtained, and it's the same agent all the way through, He obtained another search warrant against the second residence on November 28th, shortly before they executed against that residence. And in that search warrant, his statement of probable cause, which was also sworn testimony, was that they had been conducting the surveillance to ascertain the current residence of Angulo, the other individual, and they had eyes and electronic surveillance on him at the target location for at least 3 days before they did the surveillance. And Your Honor, there was no evidence that he ever had gone back to 9,000 Zuni. So you have what Agent Palat was trying to say and back away at the suppression hearing, but then you have what he said under oath in his search warrant application for the new location. So he's essentially got two search warrant applications out there saying what the residence of Angulo is and saying we found him.
Can I stop you? Let me divide those up. As it relates to the second search warrant, was that within the universe of information that the district court had when it made its decision on the suppression order?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Judge. It's in the briefing to the district court, and it was discussed at the hearing, Judge.
Okay. Well, as it relates to those two warrants, I mean, there's no necessary inconsistency between those two things. You're conducting surveillance as to where his current residence is. You don't know that his current residence is there. They said they pinged him on 2 days before before the search on the 28th, right? At being at this Dan residence. All right. So he was there. It's been accepted by the district court that he frequented that location. But that's different, is it not, from adopting that as his residence or knowing that that's his residence?
Your Honor, I believe that the reasonable way to read Agent Pilot's affidavit was that, and he put it this way because he wanted to be able to search the new residence, was that they had surveilled and obtained the evidence to ascertain Angulo's new residence and that they had seen him there on the days before. And he never mentioned him going back to the other place. So when Judge Parker said the evidence was that Angulo frequented the location, that actually wasn't what the affidavit said. It said that they were ascertaining his new residence and they found him there on multiple days and they executed against that residence as if it was his new residence.
Well, Mr. Ray,
for the district court. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Ray, I think, given the statement in the affidavit for the second search warrant, that the judge could have drawn the inference you're drawing, the judge didn't. I think what may be determinative, or at least certainly very relevant, is what information had the officers obtained between the time they got the first search warrant and the time they searched the mobile home. Tell us what that is, because from that we can decide whether the officers would likely have inferred that he moved or not. My understanding is there's some pings. They got a warrant or some device to just learn where his cell phone was, but they only got that information for a couple days before the searches were executed. Is that right?
Your Honor, I don't think it's 100% right, because, and this goes to the government's witness trying to, in some ways, not reveal everything that was going on. And that wasn't all case strategy on his part. There was a lot of questioning of him about what methods of surveillance they were using on Angulo and how often they were watching him. He indicated that they had a lot of surveillance, eyes on and electronic, on Angulo. And when I pressed him on exactly what and when, he said, "I can't reveal all of my methods." And I respect that. But what we know is
What do you mean you respect that? That sounds relevant to this fact.
Well, Judge,
so why didn't you pursue that?
we did pursue it, Judge, and he wasn't willing to reveal his surveillance method. So what he was left
Wait. If he's not willing to answer the question that's relevant to the subject, why don't you ask the judge to instruct him to answer?
Judge, we took it as far as we could, and we knew from his affidavit that Fernando Topete Madrueno never went back to 9000 Zuni. And he said in his testimony,
why do you say that? Back from, we're talking about from the date of the getting the first warrant until that warrant was executed. How did they know that Angulo had never gone back to the trailer,
Your Honor? Because Agent Pilot told us that he had eyes on surveillance on Angulo throughout that kind of period in November. Now, I do have to
before you concede, would you say that period in November, that limited time between when the warrant was obtained and when it was executed, is that what you're saying?
Yes, Judge. So here are the dates.
He said he had eyes on during that period.
Yes, Judge. And he also said they had the electronic pings. And then he said there were other methods of surveillance that he didn't tell us what they were.
But if they had those eyes on revealed that there was no indication that he had moved luggage or he had done anything that suggested that he had left that place. That's what he testified to at the suppression hearing. I mean, adopting the proffer of the prosecution as his own testimony, that's what he said.
Judge, again, that's not consistent with his search warrant affidavit on the new residence, which they then searched on the premise that that was the new residence.
Well, let me just move beyond that to suggest this. Even if one assumed that he had moved 2 days before they executed the search warrant, why was it there not a fair probability that there would be evidence of drug trafficking at that home? I mean, the whole premise of the investigation was that that home was a stash house. And just because he moved his own residence would not necessarily mean, by any stretch of the imagination, it would seem to me, that there wouldn't be some evidence of drug trafficking at that home. And so why isn't there a fair probability? And if your answer, I assume, will be no, what's the best case you have to suggest that isn't right?
Judge Holmes, so when the government says that there was evidence that that was a stash house, their evidence of it being a stash house was actually not that strong. Remember, Your Honor, they'd never observed any drug trafficking happen at that residence. They, what their evidence showed was that this individual, Angulo, was going to other locations to conduct controlled buys. Now, does that mean that that place is a stash house? I don't think that's a reasonable inference, Judge. But at the same time, remember, we're talking about, you're a roommate who no evidence has been developed against you over 8 months of you being under surveillance. And that's even evident in the search warrant application. Yet your roommate moves out. How is it plausible that with no drug trafficking ever seen happening at that place, that now you are going to see your residence door kicked down, you raided and held because your roommate who moved out a few days ago did drug transactions off site over the last 8 months?
Let's try this. The investigation, at least reading the affidavit, suggested that this was sort of a delivery kind of deal. Angulo would deliver narcotics. And so if he gets a call, I mean, if there's an arranged setup for the UC, let's use the two UC transactions. There's a call. He leaves Zuni and goes to drop off narcotics. Why isn't it a fair inference that the place he was holding the narcotics was at the residence? I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt here. We're saying, I mean, it seems like, in phrasing it a different way, why isn't it plausible for the court to adopt that reading of the facts that this was a stash house? And if it was a stash house, why would two days make all that much difference?
Judge, anything that the district court adopts has to be supported by evidence and reasonable inferences from that evidence. And what I'm talking about is that it may be true Angulo was bringing drugs from where he was living to where he did the drop-offs. But now what is being asked by the government is to make a further inference that when Angulo moves out, that he left behind valuable contraband in a place where he no longer lives and where and from the police perspective, where the person living there, they haven't developed any evidence against him. So they're just jumping to a conclusion without evidence that somebody who against whom there is no evidence developed has become the caretaker of valuable narcotics. And that is an inference I believe was not reasonable for the district court to make.
Could I skip ahead to your second issue? And here, let's go to essentially the worst case scenario for the government. And the worst case scenario is that we're relying on the good faith exception, which the district court didn't reach. I'm having a hard time seeing, when I'm talking about the search now of the edge, I'm having a hard time seeing why a reasonable officer could not rely on that warrant and affidavit to search the edge, specifically because the affidavit specifically included cars adjacent to the home as places where you store narcotics and other evidence of drug trafficking. And the car was next to the home. It had been regularly next to the home. And they mentioned the edge. So, I mean, worst case scenario, there wasn't probable cause. Why wouldn't a reasonable officer be able to rely on that affidavit and warrant And there don't seem to be the exceptions to the good faith exception at play here. So I'll stop there. Explain that to me. Why not the good faith exception if the government needed to rely on that?
Your Honor, because the good faith goes to the officer's knowledge and understanding of what is the probable cause in the situation. And we know it is undisputed that the officers did not develop any probable cause related to Mr. Topete Madrueño or his car. So to the extent that his car was mentioned in the search warrant application, it is mentioned as not being involved in any criminal activity. And the officers knew this when they applied for the warrant, and when they get the warrant back, that is a fact that they have had within their reach for 8 months. And so they know that they don't have probable cause against that car or that person. So when they put their formula of cars and vehicles and, you know, outlying buildings, they know that they don't have and shouldn't have access to that car. So Judge, what would happen if we allowed this type of search is that officers could just draft a generic search warrant where multiple people live in a house and only one of them is a target, and just use their formula for vehicles. And every roommate who has a roommate that's up to bad action, well, maybe your car gets searched just because your roommate is in trouble. And that is unreasonable. That is the standard of the Fourth Amendment. And again, Judge, these searches are invasive, and they...
Mr. Ray, your time has expired. So just maybe Judge Holmes has follow-up questions, but don't...
I do not.
Too much. Yeah, focus. Yeah.
That's what I have, Judge Holmes, and my time is expired.
Well, I know Judge Bacharach has a question. Did you say you had follow-up, Judge Holmes?
I did. No.
Oh, okay. Judge Bacharach?
I did want to follow up on Judge Holmes' question in regard to your last answer. Agent Palat identified all of that information in his affidavit. He painstakingly detailed the two sales that Angelo made in the Ford Fusion. There's several references to the Ford Edge. It's clear from the affidavit of Agent Palat that Angelo was not using the Ford Edge. He was using the Ford Fusion. So isn't your argument, you make a good argument, but isn't the flip side of that is that Agent Palat, when he and other agents are executing the search warrant that does expressly cover vehicles on the premises, including the Edge, that they're entitled to rely on what Magistrate Judge Ritter said, because he knew all of this information that you just identified, that Angelo had never been seen in the Ford Edge, and yet he still authorized a search of the Ford Edge. So doesn't the flip side of what you just said support the point that Judge Holmes is making, is that the good faith exception would support introduction of the heroin seized from the Edge?
No, Your Honor, because at bottom, the officers who are the ones obtaining the warrants and doing the surveillance and conducting these searches and seizures are ultimately responsible for the facts that they present and then what they know is probable cause or isn't. So this is a situation where it was just drastically unreasonable to conduct the search, and the officers would know it and anyone else would.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Is it Fitzenmeier?
It is Fitzenmeier, Your Honor.
Fitzenmeier, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court and Mr. Ray. My name is Mark Fitzenmeier, and I represent the United States. The defendant has raised four issues. I'm going to address each in turn and ask for questions before moving on to the next issue. With regard to the first issue, this court should affirm the district court because it did not clearly err when it found the agents did not know Angulo had moved until after they executed the search warrant at 9000 Zuni. And the district court correctly concluded that Angulo frequenting 710 Dan did not nullify a fact material to probable cause. Probable cause must exist from the issuance of a warrant until its execution. Probable cause will cease to exist where a material fact to the probable cause determination is nullified. So here we have a search warrant for 9000 Zuni that was issued on November 18th and then executed on November 28th. In between those two dates, on November 26th, law enforcement agents began receiving cell phone location information showing that Angulo had been frequenting 710 Dan. They, however, did not know that this meant he moved until after they executed the warrant at 9000 Zuni. And to answer Judge Holmes's questions with regard to the information in the 710 Dan warrant describing it as his residence, that's because the 9000 Zuni warrant was executed early in the morning at the break of dawn, and then the 710 Dan warrant wasn't obtained until after that. And in that warrant, the 710 Dan warrant, they specifically talk about how they actually already arrested Angulo at that point in time. They'd arrested him, talked to him, and he said, yes, I had moved. This is my new residence. So that's why they used the term his residence at that point in time, because he had, in fact, confirmed it himself.
Okay, so the information in the second warrant was based upon actually information gleaned from Angulo and the search that was predicated on the first warrant.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's in Volume 1, page 86. It's paragraph 49 of the 710 Dan warrant. And that was submitted as Government Exhibit 1 at the suppression hearing.
Do you have the language that Mr. Ray relied on in the second warrant that was problematic? Because I thought it indicated that they'd been looking for his new residence or to confirm the new residence before the first warrant was executed. Do you have that?
So they hadn't been looking for the residence where he was living. They were looking for him. At this point in time, when the warrant was being, when they obtained the warrant, they were trying to locate all the individuals. They lost track of some because the investigation kind of stalled. There were some individuals in California, things of that nature. So I believe the 710 Dan warrant shows an evolution of them looking for these people, getting the pings that indicated that Mr. Angulo was at 710 Dan, executing the 9000 Zuni warrant, and then confirming that he was, in fact, at 710 Dan, and that was his new residence.
Mr. Ray spoke in terms of there having been continuous surveillance of Mr. Angulo from the time that the first warrant was obtained. What is your understanding of the evidence?
I think that muddies some of the water with regard to the investigation. So my answer to that is this, that during the investigative portion of this, particularly in like that summer, there was more heavy surveillance. Then there was a state arrest of some of the members of the organization, and they sort of dropped contact with law enforcement. And law enforcement decreased surveillance because there was nothing happening in the case. By the time they issue the warrant, they haven't had the surveillance isn't as intense. And by the time the warrant is issued, they have lost track of some of the members and they're not sure where everybody is because, as I mentioned, some are in California. They have Angulo, but they also used the cell phone location information to try and track him down, which indicates that he may actually also be in a different location during some times, but he was seen in between those two time frames on November 20th at the 9000 Zuni residence. So it shows him going to both places during that time frame between the issuance and execution.
Can you talk about how long had they had the technology available to get pings for Mr. Angulo's location?
So Agent Pilot in the suppression hearing mentioned that they applied for the warrant, I believe, around the 20th, but didn't get any information for it until the 26th. So they had the 26th and 27th.
What do you mean didn't get any information for it?
Sometimes it takes the technology. I believe he explains this as well. It takes the technology companies a little while to get it up and then for them to get the information to them. So there's a lag between issuance of the warrant for the location information and the
So they didn't get the ping information until 2 days before the search was executed. Is that right?
Correct. Special Agent Pilot specifically stated that it wasn't until the 26th.
And was there any visual surveillance of Mr. Angulo during the days before execution of the second warrant?
I do know that on the 26th and 27th, I believe they surveilled the new location, but I don't recall if they saw him there or not.
And there's no evidence of anything being moved from the trailer to the new location. Is that correct?
Correct. And so the defendant's argument must fail for two reasons. First, it's entirely predicated on the agent knowing for a fact that Angulo had moved to 710 Dan. As this court has noted already, that is directly contrary to the district court's finding, and there's nothing on the record to indicate that they clearly erred. They have factual support for that. Secondly,
here's the language. I think it's paragraph 49 of the affidavit. Mr. Ray can nod his head if that's what he was referring to. It says, on November 26, 2018, agent had conducted surveillance to determine Rodriguez Velasquez's current residence as part of the investigation. That's strange language to use if they thought he was still at the trailer on the 26th.
Oh, I don't agree with that characterization. I believe because at the time they're asking for this warrant, they know he has the new residence at 710 Dan. So to the extent it's like a typographical error, they're working in the present tense in that document because as that same paragraph notes, they have arrested him. He has confirmed that he lives at 710 Dan at that point in time. But this is all the way after the 9,000 Zuni warrants are executed.
Thank you.
Go ahead. And then finally, the other reason that this argument must fail is that, as this court has also noted, this is more than just a search for Angulo. This wasn't just like an arrest warrant for him. This was a search of a residence for drug evidence. And so just because Mr. Angulo wasn't at 9,000 Zuni anymore doesn't mean he took all the evidence with him. And Special Agent Pilot specifically testified on page 50 of volume 3 that he believed at the time they were executing the warrant that even if he wasn't there, they would have been able to find some drug trafficking evidence there. And barring any additional questions from the court on this particular issue, I will move on to the second issue.
Which you in terms of the car?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good.
So with regard to the second issue, this court should affirm the district court's finding that the defendant did not establish standing because there was no evidence of a subjective expectation of privacy, nor was there any evidence of lawful possession such that society would be objectively willing to recognize it.
Go ahead, Judge Becker.
Oh, sorry, Judge Charles. In terms of an expectation of privacy, so the defendant, Mr. Tepete, tells the agents, you can return the car to the owner of the car. But I didn't see anything in the suppression hearing about returning the contents of the vehicle. Now, obviously, he's not going to say return the heroin. I want that heroin back. But there was a exhibit C to the affidavit or to the warrant does identify a cell phone that was located in the Ford Edge. And there's nothing about him saying, give that cell phone to anybody else. In fact, the record is silent about what he said about returning the contents of the vehicle. He had been surveilled pretty consistently, as you point out, from November 20th to the date of the execution of the warrant, I think on the 28th, there had never been any mention in the suppression hearing or in the affidavit about Angulo being seen in that Ford Edge. And so why is it that there was anything other than a reasonable expectation that Tepete did have permission to use that vehicle? Nobody had ever insinuated, given any reason to believe, that he had stolen the vehicle. And it'd be a little bit strange to say, yeah, return the vehicle to the guy that I stole the car from.
So with regard to the ownership of the items in the vehicle, Your Honor is correct in that there was no evidence that he ever claimed any ownership of it.
Or was asked anything about it. In other words, you're right. He never said, give me the cell phone back, but nor is there any information that he didn't do it. The record is just completely silent about that.
Correct, Your Honor. And it's his burden to establish standing. And I think that's the easiest way to decide that particular issue is he didn't establish it then or at the hearing, and therefore it doesn't fall in his favor. Similarly,
let me step out standing with respect to the search of the vehicle. Don't you have standing if you possess the vehicle with the permission of the owner?
Yes, Your Honor.
And can't you infer that he had the permission of the owner from the facts here? The long-term use of it in the same area where the owner was? I mean, we look at all the facts, not just the facts known at the time of the search for standing. We look at the record when the judge rules on standing. But I would think it's a very reasonable inference that he had the permission of the owner to use this vehicle.
Your Honor, and I would say that another inference is that it was potentially stolen or that it was potentially under duress. And the fact that they were making these inferences and these guesses shows that he did not meet his burden with regard to that particular aspect of this analysis.
Was there any evidence elicited at the suppression hearing that there was suspicion that he had stolen the vehicle or that the FBI had done a records check and that there was a report of the Ford Edge being stolen or that Agent Pilote ever suspected that it was stolen or being driven without the owner's permission? Was there any information about that in the record?
No, Your Honor, there was no evidence in that regard. There is no evidence whatsoever with regard to the lawfulness of the possession. And I think that's the crux of the biscuit with regard to this analysis.
That's not true. That's not true. You're ignoring common sense. If this car has been gone from the owner for months and not reported stolen, and this person is openly using it for that period of time, and as soon as he's arrested, he says, return this to so-and-so, that's pretty good evidence that it was with the permission of the owner. I would believe it. I would be convinced by it. Maybe another fact finder wouldn't, but don't say there's no evidence. I think that ignores common sense. What am I missing?
You know, I think I would point to Valdez-Hawker as an example of why maybe that's not true. In Valdez-Hawker, the defendant testified and he was able to elicit a specific relationship with regard to the owner, the person that possessed the vehicle, and himself. And therefore, there was specific identifiable information that there was at least some sort of lawful possession and or based on the relationship, he could reasonably believe that it was lawful. Here, there's just no evidence. And I think we're left guessing for a lot of these things because a reasonable mind could disagree with you and could possibly argue that either the registered owner was under duress for some reason, didn't feel comfortable reporting it because of the nature of the community in which he lives. Involving law enforcement is frowned upon in some communities. And then it could have just been stolen and maybe no one noticed. So I think there is a lack of evidence with regard to the lawfulness of the possession. And as a result, the defendant hasn't met his burden. And again, it was his burden to prove that.
I read somewhere that there was evidence that he started driving the car and that some other member of the drug trafficking organization had driven the car before him. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. There was evidence that the prior owner of the car was a member of the same drug trafficking organization.
And where did that information come out? And was that available to the district court?
It was. It was in the suppression hearing, and it came from Special Agent Pilate. And I believe it was during Mr. Ray's cross-examination of him.
Before you're off of here, let me ask one logistical question. What is Exhibit 25 and 26 that were the subject of the last issue, I guess, which relates to the belatedly introduced information? What was 25 and 26?
I don't recall specifically off the top of my head, Your Honor. That information in general involved three things: text messages, pictures retrieved from a phone, and then jail calls were generally involved in that issue. I don't remember specifically which numbers correspond to which.
Okay, because I know what 20 was. I know what 22 was. I thought 26 was the other phone of San Diego or something, but all right, I'll figure it out.
And to to pivot to that issue briefly, Your Honor. It was
your time has expired. Does anyone have questions or want him to pursue? Is there? I mean, maybe a lot of time on questions. I'll give you a minute to address some other issue that you think we need to understand better, Mr. Fitzmaier.
Your Honor, barring any additional questions from the court, I won't take that grant of time, and I appreciate it. And I would just ask that the court affirm the district court on all the issues presented here today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted and counsel are excused.